Talk given Sunday, 5th November, 1972.
As far as we know from scholarly research, the original inhabitants of India are people about whom we know nothing whatsoever as yet, for certain. Some scholars think that what has been discovered through the researches of anthropologists and their co-workers concerns people who came into India from the West. People called Negritos and Proto-Australoids. Don't get misled by the word Australoid. They didn't come from the Australasian region. There is a small sprinkling of Austroasiatic peoples also in India. But they did not play, as far as we know, such an important part as these Negritos and Proto-Australoids did, who came mainly from the North African shores and from the Eastern African region. From the West, they came to the East. The Negritos are amongst the oldest. You will find pure descendants of these Negrito peoples, who it is thought came in quite 70 centuries ago, in certain places in India, in the high hills of the south of India, in places like Chotanagpur, and in various little hill tribes in the Himalayan regions, and also particularly in the Andaman Islands and the Nicobars. Some of them went into Ceylon too, but we can leave Ceylon out for the moment. And probably at the same time, or maybe shortly after them, there came the people who are called Proto-Australoids, who are a much more developed stock physically. You can see any number of photographs of Australoid features, faces, and the Negrito types. And the two are very different indeed. These Australoids must have been quite an unusual race of people. So must the Negritos, because remember, they couldn't go and book a seat on a plane to get to India in those days. They walked 2,500 miles across terrain which was not like the charming woodlands of England. It was very difficult terrain indeed. And they walked right across Western Asia and entered India through the passes of the Hindu Kush Mountains, the classic route of all who have come from the West until recent times. Across the Suleiman Mountains, across the highlands of Baluchistan, and perhaps they may have come by sea in some way or other across parts south of, just by the south of Iran and western India. That's a possibility. So they entered India that way, and in the course of about 1500 to 2000 years, they spread right through the subcontinent. They pushed down into Burma, down into southeastern Asia, through the daunting jungles of that region. The Salween Mekong region is a very difficult region to get through at the best of times, even now. And in those days, it must have been an almost impenetrable region. and right into Indonesia, up to New Guinea. No one could say that they didn't have a land-faring, if not a seafaring, urge and spirit. Now, these people came into a land. It is important to appreciate the whole of the background. They came into a land which was a rich forest land, fed by warm rains. It was quite different in those days, in a great many parts of the subcontinent, from what it is today. Today we have rather large desert tracts, arid lands in western India, the northwestern India, I mean, and in central and south India, considerably bare arid tracts. But in those days, these lands were covered by rich forest. The fall of leaf century after century made the soil extremely fertile. And the rainfall probably was very plentiful. There was one very great advantage in these forest lands as compared with the forest lands of Africa and Central South America. In Africa and in South America, the jungle was too fierce. It grew at such a rate, it encroached so swiftly upon any clearance that those people could have made, that there was no possibility whatsoever of any large settlement of people growing up in any one place. And if that is the case, the division of a sufficient division of labor is not possible, and the arts of peace and civilization have hardly any opportunity to flourish. Now, this was the great difference between these forest lands, those of Africa and Central South America, as compared with India. China had somewhat different conditions. China had an extremely cold climate, remember, always. But let's not go into China. That would take us too far afield for our purposes. So it was in this land that the Negritos and Proto-Australoids were able to establish, in the course of the centuries, quite stable village settlements. Now, these people must never be regarded as primitive in the sense of savage, far from it. They had a simple order, and the rule of law prevailed amongst them. True, they were totemistic people, and they had their particular taboos and their particular way of life, but it was a settled, orderly way of life, and people lived according to the rules. This must be borne in mind carefully. Obviously, they had very simple arts and crafts, if any, weaving, pottery, and the usual things which make up the village life of very simple primitive communities. Remember, we are talking of the period from 70 centuries ago coming close to our times. So they spread right through India and established village settlements. What were their some of their more interesting and important religious beliefs and ideas? Of course, they worshipped the sun and the moon and spirits of this, that and the other, spirits of the mountains, of the rivers, thunder, lightning and all the rest of it. But what is of great interest to us is their idea of an indestructible life essence, which resided in every human being, and that this was situated in the head. Generally speaking, it was the head, different tribes had slightly different ideas, but most of them thought it was situated in the head. At death, this life essence went into the soil and re-emerged in the crops. If a pregnant woman ate of food made out of from these crops, that life essence quickened the fetus, and lo and behold, another living being came. The important point is that they had this peculiar sense that something other than the purely material is involved in the emergence of a human being. Because a human being has psyche, has desires, will, thought, feeling, all the rest of it. And so this is how they put it. And that these are the characteristics of life itself. You can see how vague ideas like this paved the way for the emergence of doctrines like reincarnation. The life essence of the person who died went into the soil, came out again like that, and once again was in human beings. Then they also believed that every living person had a psychical power, his personal magic, mana or aran, as they called it. Remember, they were totemistic. Such and such totems were harmonious to each other, friendly with each other. Others were inimical. They wouldn't agree with each other. You may marry someone from a totem which is favorable to yours, not with an inimical, not into an inimical totem, you see. You may dine with anybody who belongs to the friendly totem. You mustn't invite the wrong Mr. Smith to dinner. Only the right Mr. Smith can come to dinner with you. That sort of idea. Now, remember that they thought of this life essence as being situated in the head. Later on, some of the tribes also conceived of this as a manikin soul, a definite soul as such, a manikin, therefore human. They are anthropomorphizing their ideas now, situated in the head. One sees the connection between this and the practice of head hunting and the practice of warriors when they slew the enemy, to split open his skull. You see? They thought that you thereby obtained some peculiar power forever over that person, and so forth. All these ideas were tied up with their conceptions of magical power, of spirits, and so forth. On these people, there came the impact of various other groups, all coming from the West. Of these, the most important were the people who founded the Indus Valley civilization, some 20 centuries after the first Negritos and Proto-Australoids came in. People from, particularly from Sumeria and Armenia, came into India. Now these people enjoyed a very highly developed civilization. They were builders of cities. They were a very practical people, a people with great skill as craftsmen. The Armenians were a brachycephalic, broad-headed people, and the Sumerians contained people who were dolichocephalic, long-headed. These two were amongst the main groups who contributed and built up the whole of the Indus Valley civilization. First they settled in the Indus Basin, built their cities there. And they gradually spread over the Indo-Gangetic Plain. It is not probable that they penetrated very deeply into Bengal, and certainly, as far as we know, eastwards into Assam and such places. Branches of these people went down southwards by the west coast, right down towards Malabar. We have plenty of evidence, even to this day, of the sort of culture that they established, because the life of several of the people in these regions reflects the kind of life which flourished in the Indus Valley. And then they turned up eastwards towards Madras. Those were their main lines for spreading themselves through the subcontinent. Now these people built cities, and the second great stage in the life of India begins. First, the village settlements of the Negritos and Proto-Australoids, followed by the cities built by these Indus Valley people. They built cities which have been a source of astonishment to our archaeologists in this century. In the early 1920s, the cities particularly of Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, to cite two of the most famous instances, were dug up. They are remarkably well planned. That is to say, well planned according to their conceptions and for those days. They are very geometrical, all in squares, just like that. But they made their the directions of their streets follow the direction of the prevailing winds, which would clean out the city. They also had quite an advanced drainage system, non-existent in the India of the last 2,000 years. This was, remember, about 5,000 years ago. Latter-day India didn't have anything like this. Good, efficient drainage systems. They had indoor sanitation. Brick-built houses, and the bricks are rather large, 16 inches by 5 by 3 1/4 or something like that. Large bricks, and they were so well-baked that when these cities were dug up, there they were still standing just like that. They were skilled workers in gold, silver, ivory. They made an enormous number of all sorts of little ornaments, trinkets with semi-precious stones and so forth, and engraved them with a pictographic script which to this day remains undeciphered. If only we could discover the correspondent of a Rosetta Stone, we might find out a great deal about what these people thought and believed and felt. Temples are known, but a palace is something of a rarity. There are magnificent big public baths and so forth. As far as we can gather, they had perhaps a republican order rather than a monarchical one. And of course they used carts, with two-wheeled carts, in order to transport their goods, because their streets, which are cobbled, bear the marks of where these cart wheels went, and so forth. They certainly had considerable development, again considerable for those days, in music, mathematics, astronomy. Their pottery is really quite astonishing. Beautiful painted designs, mostly geometrical designs. It looks as if their geometrical designs were symbolical designs to represent some of their religious conceptions. Now, a good many scholars have felt that they were a sort of a very practical, materialistic race. We can question that. If they came around about 3000 BC from Sumeria and Armenia, and remember that they naturally traded with their old homeland, the towns Ur, Eridu, Lagash, Larsa, are names to conjure with for the archaeologist in all these matters, and they carried out a very considerable trade with them. And if they came from there around about 3000 BC, which incidentally, I'm not suggesting this as a historical fact, but just incidentally, 3000 BC roughly corresponds with the date of Enoch in Genesis, the seventh in the line from Adam. Now, the line from Adam, the second line, that is, not the first line, not the Cain-Abel one, but the second one, which starts with Seth. You see? The seventh in the line is Enoch, and his name means teacher, intuition. And there is a famous book of Enoch, which is a very remarkable text belonging to Kabbalistic teaching. Now, if they came from there, is it impossible that they brought the wisdom of the Kabbalah with them? We cannot rule that out. If you look at that picture over there, you will see on the right-hand side, amongst those little circles and colored designs, the Star of David, six-pointed. The Star of David. Now, how is it that a Kabbalistic symbol is present in something which deals with Indian yoga? That is only one example. There are several other examples possible. I'm not suggesting that this was so, but it is not impossible that it could have been so. And it is a line of research which later on hasn't been done up to date as far as I know. It's a line of research which might interest modern scholars. To what extent did the wisdom of the Kabbalah enter India? 3000 BC. Remember that in 2000 BC, Abraham goes west from the city of Ur, which means light. The meaning of that word, of that name, is light. He goes westwards, and we have the whole history of the development of Judaism and so forth. Well, now, Indus Valley people were overrun by our common ancestors, the Aryan-speaking people. The term Aryan has been used by scholars, especially in the early part of this century, to represent the language spoken by the people. It's not an ethnical term. Essentially, they were not Aryans ethnically by race, by blood. They were Aryans by language. And the word Aryan simply means worthy or noble. And the idea of that worthiness is related to the use of the plow, agriculture, to use the plow. See, he who used the plow was worthy. Possibly, it may have meant, at least to some of those people in those days, that he who lived by following a peaceful art, agriculture, was a person worthy to follow the religious life and ultimately realize transcendence. These are possibilities. We mustn't rule them out. Now, these people were tall, virile, vigorous, haughty, full of the conceit of race, and a great sense of superiority because of their very fair skin, and they came from beyond the 40th parallel of latitude. They were, by comparison with the Indus Valley people, rude, intruding barbarians, as far as the ordinary way of life in the world was concerned. They were armed with horse and sword, the iron sword. Now, the horse was a native of the snowy slopes between Mongolia and Siberia. And some 27 centuries before the birth of Christ, the horse was first tamed, one of the last animals to be tamed by man. Since then, he has been busy, or some humans have been busy, taming themselves, not very successfully. They have not tamed any other animals. The horse was tamed then. Now, when the horse was tamed, the people who rode horses had a tremendous advantage in every respect over people who used other animals. Your elephant, your camel, as a transport animal is not comparable, at least in those days, certainly was not comparable to the horse because of his mobility. For one thing, his fleetness, his tameability, and the extent to which he would respond to man as compared with the other animals. And not only that, the horse could obtain his food even in snowy territory by pawing the ground. Your elephant can't do that. Your camel can't do it. And your camel sometimes is slightly ill-tempered. He uses his hind legs very effectively. Be very careful how you approach a camel. We have a saying in India. This is especially so amongst the Parsis, that if a person is really bad-tempered and sort of turns around upon you like that, snarls at you, we call him Oont. He's a camel. See? Well now, the horse had very great advantages. About 15 centuries before the birth of Christ, or probably a few more, the Hittites of Anatolia discovered superior methods for smelting iron. And from that time onwards, the iron sword, which they made, proved an instrument of decision in all military matters as compared with the bronze swords and other weapons that other people had. The Hittites of Anatolia, Asia Minor, must have had some sort of contact with these Aryan-speaking peoples. These Aryan-speaking peoples, although it is thought that they came from north of the 40th parallel of latitude, are also thought, especially by men like the late Professor Gordon Child. I remember him talking to me about this quite a long while, you know, because he rather disputed the Central Asian steppe land origin of the Aryan peoples. He said they came from the Ukraine, the rich black earth lands of southern Russia. That's where the Aryan-speaking people came from. Well, goodness knows where they actually came from. There are theories, with some considerable evidence to support these theories, that they came right down from the Arctic regions. They were extremely fair-skinned, remember. You are their descendants. I am their descendant also. And look at the variety of color between the brown-skinned peoples of India and Iran and the much lighter-skinned peoples of Greece and of Italy, and the fair-skinned peoples, the Slavs, the Teutons, the Celts. These are all one single race. The great migrations of the Aryan-speaking peoples may have started as far back as 45 centuries ago. Professor Emile Bonveniste of the Sorbonne was very definite that they started 4,500 BC. That's 65 centuries ago. But most scholars are of the opinion that probably the migration started something like between 2,500 and 2,000 BC. Some would bring the date down to even 1500 BC. Be that as it may, those people were on the march. Why were they on the march? If you look at a map of Europe and Asia beyond the 40th parallel of latitude, look in the Asian part. Those very arid, inhospitable steppe lands right across Siberia for thousands of miles have a terrible climate, particularly in winter. -2 in Tomsk, -12 in Krasnoyarsk, -45 in Yakutsk. Those are the temperatures in which they play cricket. You see? Now, these people were pastoral nomads. They had only their herds. They were warrior herdsmen. They had their herds, and the climate made them move every year approximately 1,000 miles away from their own home territory because the climate was so severe. And they came back. And then there came a time, it is thought, this is a conjecture from what little evidence there has been available, that what finally made them migrate to the extent that they did was very severe drought, pests of locusts, and so on, which decided them to come down to much more hospitable climes. So down they came. Of course, the Pamirs, you remember the map of Europe, of Asia. The Pamirs, the highest plateau in the world, are a great knot, so to say, from which there radiate 1,500 miles of the Himalayas southeastwards, 2,500 miles of the Quinlan Mountains going that way, and then the mountains which go northeastwards, the Altintags, the Altais, the Yablonois, Stanovois, right up to the Bering Strait. This way, the great arid wastes, so to say, till you come to the Caspian and then on into the Ukraine with its rich black earthlands. So these people came southwards to Afghanistan, and then they parted two streams. One went eastwards over the Hindu Kush Mountains, the famous passes, the Khyber and the Bolan. They were the main routes of entry, and into the Punjab, the Indus Valley region. Land literally flowing with milk and honey as compared with what they were accustomed to. And westward, the other group went into Iran, not such a hospitable region, right up to Azerbaijan, which brought them again a little bit southeastwards of the Caspian. Of this, we have very definite evidence because we have records to show that Aryan princes were ruling in the Mitanni, the plain of the Mitanni, in the extreme western part, where they went, from 1746 BC onwards. Why did they part? Why didn't they all keep together? One group wanted to continue the worship of several gods. The other group wanted to dispense with the worship, ritual worship of many gods, and confine themselves to the worship of a single god. A definite theism as such. The group which went westward into Iran, well, that was the group out of which there sprang Zarathustrianism, which is the very first great religion of the world, which presents the God concept as a purely spiritual and ethical concept. There is no anthropomorphism at all attached to it. Ahura Mazda, Lord of Life and Wisdom, or rather it would be better to translate it as Living Lord of Wisdom. Ahura Mazda is to be seen and known in purest vision and essence. Essence. Not in substantial terms. This is the interesting point about those people. But the people who went eastwards took with them the Rig Veda. They brought the Rig Veda. These Aryan-speaking peoples, rude, intruding barbarians, virile, vigorous, haughty, pastoral nomads, warrior herdsmen, and so forth, brought the Rig Veda with them. We call them barbarians. But is it justified? If physical conditions and environment compelled them to live a somewhat fierce life, what was there in them which enabled them to bring that supreme treasure, the oldest religious document of the entire Indo-European race, the Rig Veda? See, we have to be very sensitive and use our imagination in the right way. Not let our imagination run away with us, but use it in the right way. These people were a race of poets. They were extremely tolerant, despite the quarrels between nomadic groups. They were extremely tolerant, and they proved their tolerance to the hilt after they entered India. And they were very good organizers. In certain ways, they seem to bear a peculiar resemblance to some of the qualities of the people of this country. Race of poets. Tolerant. Good organization. Not a rigid organization according to what is laid down in the Blue Book. But they were practical, they were experimental. They looked at what was present and dealt with it accordingly. Now these were the peculiar qualities which those people had, and they brought with them the Rig Veda. Now, the tendency has been for Western scholarship, especially during the middle of the last century and onwards, until about 40 years ago, to regard the Rig Veda exclusively as the religion of a polytheistic, nature-worshipping people. There are good reasons for coming to that conclusion, because the Rig Veda is the one and only religious document in the world which shows which embodies the whole process of God-making in man's conceptions. You get animism. You get naturalistic polytheism. You get theistic tendencies displayed. And you get monistic tendencies shown. That the absolute all, the absolute is the one ultimate reality, the impersonal absolute, and so forth. All these are present in the Rig Vedic hymns. The Rig Veda consists of 1,027 hymns, as they are called. They are hymns which bear some resemblance to the Psalms, but they are very different. As far as I can see, and mind you, this is unreliable because I do not know Vedic as the original language. I only know the Rig Veda from translation. The Rig Vedic hymns haven't the same beauty, literary excellence, as the Psalms of the Bible have. But unlike the Psalms of the Bible, they cover a much wider field of expression, not only religious, but in various hymns there are indications of the state of affairs in India. These hymns are the very root, the living root of the great ritual systems which characterized the Aryan-speaking people. Now, the time has come when we can completely discount the ordinary conventional scholarship designation of the nature of the Rig Vedic hymns. Some scholars even went to the extent of saying that they are the gropings after spiritual reality of a primitive people. To put it directly in its true form, and I unhesitatingly say its true form, the hymns of the Rig Veda represent the different states of mind and consciousness which you yourself go through in your ascent out of the mire of confusion and sorrow and ignorance right up to the transcendental heights of the realization of transcendence itself. That is what the hymns of the Rig Veda represent. Whosoever has lived the religious life, whosoever has known anything of what holiness really is, whosoever has been touched by that magic of the transcendent, will have his eyes, inward eyes opened, and he will see just exactly what the hymns of the Rig Veda are about. It is perfectly true that the literary expression is anthropomorphic. The gods are individuals. They are given descriptions. Some of them are quite naturalistic descriptions because they are associated with the phenomena of nature. But we must ask ourselves, if you consider the period of the Rig Veda, probably from at least 2,000, if not more, years before the birth of Christ, we must ask the question, what option had those people but to use this kind of language? If you look at the God conceptions which began to spring up from about the 7th and 6th centuries BC, and remember, 7th and 6th centuries as compared with way back 20 and 25 centuries BC, if you look at the God conceptions of both India and of Greece, to give one example, which began to spring up from that time onwards, you will see that the God conceptions are so very different because, and this is the fundamental reason for it, man's knowledge of the nature of things had grown so tremendously. His conception of matter was quite different from the conception of matter of people 4,000 and 5,000 years ago. Now you might wonder, what is the relationship? According to the way you regard matter, according to the extent to which you have true knowledge or truer knowledge of matter, will be your theological and philosophical description of that which belongs to the realm of transcendence. This is very definitely known if you study the whole history of theological expression through the ages. The principal determining factor in the new expression as regards the nature of ultimate reality, of deity and so forth, was man's conception that all matter originates from primordial atoms. The atomic theory, in other words, has been the most responsible factor for the change in the presentation of man's concepts of deity. These atoms were postulated as invisible, as indivisible, as indestructible. They were postulated as created by a supreme absolute power, and that ultimately they would be reabsorbed, this was in India, reabsorbed by that supreme absolute power. But if these atoms, which were indivisible, indestructible, invisible, were the primordial source of all that is manifest, and the creative power is ascribed to deity, then deity itself must be invisible, indestructible, and indivisible. So you see, the abstract philosophical concepts of which entered the world of religion are dependent upon the extent to which we understand matter. Now, the people of the Rig Veda had no means to express themselves in any other way than they did. Their concept was that there were innumerable spirits which were embodied in stones and trees and mountains and rivers and all the rest of it. So naturally, the hymns of the Rig Veda are couched in that type of language. But that does not in the least justify mere intellectual scholarship from declaring that they are the primitive, they are the gropings after spiritual reality of a primitive people. Their sensitivity had brought them right to the pitch of complete holiness and the fulfillment of the purpose of their existence as human beings. They were perfected holy ones of a stature no less, comparison is, as I have always said, really bad in this context, but let us use these terms for the time being, no less than any other example of perfection and holiness throughout human history. And these were the great poet seers who wrote the hymns of the Rig Veda. Now if we see that, if we really understand that, then it will be not only possible, but more worthwhile studying some of the hymns of the Rig Veda, looking into them and seeing what their real meanings are. And at our next fortnightly meeting, we will try and go into some of these hymns of the Rig Veda. And I shall try to consider together with you some of the real inner esoteric teachings which are embodied in those hymns of the Rig Veda.